Welcome to another episode of What Matters in North Carolina. I'm your host, Matt Calder, and we've got a packed show for you today. But first, to start off, I want to take care of some housekeeping. If you are not already subscribed to the podcast, make sure you're doing that by going and searching wherever you listen to podcasts and searching What Matters in North Carolina. That is What Matters in North Carolina, wherever you listen to podcasts. Also, if you are not following along with us on social media, do so by searching What Matters NC on Facebook and Twitter. On Facebook and Twitter, that is What Matters NC, as in North Carolina. If you are inclined to listen to more episodes of this show or more shows on the Freedom Action Network, make sure you do that by going to www.freedomactionnetwork.com. Again, that is www.freedomactionnetwork.com. Now, on today's show, we are going to be talking with Brooke Medina, who was actually one of our interns here in the Civitas Institute office, who recently wrote an article about how we as a society have abdicated our community relations in favor of online relationships, social media relationships, keeping in touch through Facebook, while losing our connection to our community and our civic organizations and our neighbors. Do you know your neighbors' names on all sides? Or when was the last time you spoke to your neighbors? Well, that is exactly what Brooke is talking about. But not just that, but also who has gone in to fill that void. And that will be none other than the government. The government has grown to fill the voids left by people not being as involved in their communities, in their churches, in their Lions organizations, the Kiwanis clubs, the Veterans of Foreign Wars, the 4-H, the Boy Scouts, you name it. Listen to Brooke and I talk about her article on that as well. We will also hear a conversation from Francis DeLuca and Susan Myrick, also of the Civitas Institute, talking about what changes are in store and what's going on with the State Board of Elections, if we can really call it that, as things are moving forward and boards are coming together, the Ethics Commission, the State Board of Elections, but really where the power sits. Is it with the State Board of Elections who was appointed, or is it with the staff? Is it with the director? You'll have to tune into that conversation to find out. Then we will hear from Susan Myrick again to talk with us about how unaffiliated voters are growing in the state to the point where they are going to overtake Republicans, and while that is happening and Republicans are, I guess, in danger of being overtaken, they are not the ones who are losing ranks. That would, in fact, be the Democrats. If you want to hear more about that, you'll have to listen to that segment. So now we will move right into our segment with Brooke Medina.
All right, so now we're talking with Brooke Medina about a recent article she posted on the Civitas Institute website talking about oversized government and undersized communities, it kind of sounds like. So how are you doing today, Brooke?
I'm good. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. Will you kind of start us off by talking about what your article is about and kind of giving us a little overview of what you wrote?
Okay, that would be great. So in this article, I was desiring to just delve into a topic that many of us just intuitively know when we observe the current situation politically and societally in the United States. And really what we're witnessing and what we have witnessed over these past 40 years is just a steady decline in the United States of community involvement. The federal government, of course, has seen this as well, and they've tried to respond to those needs. And in the process, they continue to expand their depth and breadth, which, is debatable as to whether or not that's beneficial to society at large. So this article is just really beginning to unpack that. There will be more to follow, but this is basically the introduction to that conversation that many people all across the country are having.
So this is kind of talking about the decline of like the 4-H club and the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, and for adults, Rotary, the JCs, and all these like these civic organizations, and the decline in membership that they're seeing, which leads to a decline in people taking care of their community, right? Is that what you're saying?
Yes, definitely. So we are witnessing that sort of decline in those civic organizations. We're also seeing a decline in just involvement in religious institutions, even just an involvement in one's neighborhood, you know, caring about the people that live next door to us. I have moved throughout the country for the past 14 years, and what I have seen living from on the West Coast and on the East Coast is there is an abundance of people living in neighborhoods that don't really even know who they're living next to, and that's a problem. I believe that we need to address. It shouldn't be that we're islands unto ourselves, and of course some people might debate that, but I think that the proof is in the pudding. So the fruit of what we're seeing in society, where there is so much partisanship and so much disconnect with those that we could otherwise try to find some common ground with, is just it's spreading like wildfire, to be sure. We see that quite regularly, even in this most recent election in 2016. And my suggestion is that we could address those problems if we look more towards community rather than federal government for the answers.
Yeah, and I can totally relate to that, just thinking about my neighborhood, because I know the names of the people across the street, but all I know about them is they have an annoying dog. It's a little white chihuahua. And then the people directly to my right, I don't even know her name. All I know is she has two annoying dogs, and she sees on her back porch all the time, basically hanging out. And then on the other side of her is another annoying dog that will not go away from my fence. And that's all I know about those three people. Now, my neighbor on my left side, I know them. I talk to them, so it's a little better there. But, I mean, really, in my neighborhood, I know the person directly next to me.
Right.
And that's it.
And that's not the exception. That's by far the rule here in the United States. I would say the vast majority of people do not know their neighbors. And that, I think, stems, though, more from the centralization of not only government, but centralization of socialization through the medium of social media, for example. So many Americans are opting to live their lives vicariously, maybe through their social media account, rather than actually going out on their streets and in their communities and getting to know those people that surround them. So, you know, just to even speak a little bit more to that point, Mark Zuckerberg was recently interviewed in a CNBC article where he was celebrating the 2 billion monthly user milestone that Facebook had just reached. And if you don't know Mark Zuckerberg, which most people do, he is the founder of Facebook. But what he was really celebrating was this vision that he was seeing come to fruition, which the vision was to create community through this social media giant. But my point in writing this article and discussing the Zuckerberg story is that what he was celebrating really emphasizes what we are lacking in society, which is something to unify our lives. We're finding it on Facebook, or at least a false version of it. Whereas my proposal and the impetus for my article, which was one written by Senator Lee of Utah, is that we need to rebuild community so that we don't have Facebook and federal government filling that void that have been left in the wake of people becoming more reclusive.
So I wonder, though, is there a place for both? Because you were talking about how you have moved all across the country over the last 14 years. So you've met a lot of people who are not in your direct community anymore. They're friends from other places, and Facebook and social media allows you to stay connected with them. So how do you balance that with trying to insert yourself in your immediate community at the same time?
Very good question. And that's an important point. We do not live in the 19th century or the 20th century anymore. We are in the 21st century. And I believe that social media has some great promise and has already been just such a great way in which we can connect with those that are in other parts of the country. My goal in writing this article, though, is to shine a light on how much we have actually become just more members of that community rather than the actual tangible community around us. So I would say we need to order our priorities, and I would question Facebook community being put above just, you know, physical community within our own neighborhood and our own city.
Right. And I see that, and I go, it's so easy to fall into that, though. It's so easy to go on and say, all right, what's this guy from high school doing? What's, you know, so-and-so got married, so-and-so had a baby. You talk about your family. If your family doesn't live close, my cousin's doing this. And it's so easy to just fall right in and have that, you know, quote-unquote need for community met in a way that doesn't actually improve your immediate community.
Right. And that's the thing. So as you cited those examples of seeing what a friend from high school is up to or a cousin that lives far away, those are really important things. And that is definitely, Facebook is one of the ways that I have used to keep connected with so many friends. And so I am not slighting it in the least. I am merely suggesting that we use it, if we're interacting with people that live locally, let's use it in a way that springboards actual physical contact with those people as well. You know, it's one thing if someone loses a family member, for example, it's one thing to offer condolences on a social media post. It's an entirely different thing to actually show up at that memorial service or in the hospital where someone that you know is fighting. So I just think that Facebook and social media can be used as that springboard to go into deeper community, but let's just make sure that we don't replace real community with it.
Oh, yeah. And it's not even like the, you know, major intense moments like a death in the family. It's, you know, I get a notification. If I'm sure if I go to my Facebook right now, it will tell me whose birthday it is. I'm sure it's one of my Facebook friends' birthdays. Most, you know, more often than not, it is. But me clicking that, and then it lets me put a little message without even having to go to their page. Versus if I pick up the phone and call that person and say, hey, happy birthday. Or even a text message as opposed to just doing it on Facebook. It's a different thing. It means a different thing. And really, I mean, we've kind of gotten off of the federal government side of this and talking more about the social media side. But so what came first in this kind of the egg or the chicken, you know, argument? Was this the federal government moved into a hole that was left behind, or was this there was the encroachment of the federal government and the community kind of goes, well, they're doing this now?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question, and I believe that it deserves its own conversation. A lot of what we see, I think, was it stemmed from good intentions, even as far back as the 1930s with Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal, wherein we saw suffering Americans and wanted to help those and ensure that the poverty that we witnessed and the economic devastation sandwiched between two world wars didn't happen again. So largely, I would say that the growth of federal government has stemmed from good intentions on the part of some, not all, though. But my concern has really been that what federalism ought to mean to the state of North Carolina. So the growth of federal government has meant that we have entrusted Washington, D.C. with so much responsibility that we in North Carolina want to actually have a say in. But we're relinquishing that say when we continue to rely upon government-backed programs and initiatives that we expect to cultivate these strong communities when that responsibility really rests on us. And so I know that this sounds like an indictment against society as a whole, but it's really not. It's just the hopes of raising awareness and amplifying this message, which is that if we want to see society change, that's up to us. It's not a government program that's going to do that for us. Government programs don't bring food to our neighbors. You know, government programs aren't the shoulder that we cry on. they are not the person or the program that plays soccer with my son. Now, can we use government programs like, let's say, you know, city parks and recreation for a soccer game? Of course we can. But let's be careful at what, and let's be conscious and mindful of what we're sacrificing when we continue to look to big government to solve a lot of our economic problems and family issues.
I mean, you can relate this idea to other things, though, too. Like, it's basically anything you take your eye off the ball. You if you're not engaged in what your child is learning and being taught, public school will take over. And they'll be learning whatever goes on there. If you're not taking care of your community through these civic organizations, government's going to step in and try and do those things. So whatever you want to be involved in and have a say in, you really need to do.
Absolutely. I mean,
that seems like your core point. And then I think in the long run, you'll be better off for it.
Yes, I agree. And the thing is, when you're in community and when you're actually providing a say in what goes on in your surroundings, you're the one with eyes on the ground, right? Just like the military, the ones with boots on the ground are the ones that are best prepared and equipped to make some of those difficult calls that, okay, someone over in DC could make, but are they really the best equipped to make it? And I would argue that the same is the case with certain economic initiatives and welfare initiatives. Those people that are actually living among those that are suffering and hurting are the best ones to really reach out and extend a hand up. It's not, you know, it could come in the form of a check, sure. And actually conservatives have largely proved that they're willing to provide help in the form of a check, but it's been in the form of their own private funds rather than the liberal progressive approach of requiring government to provide that check for somebody at the expense of taxpayers that have no say or have no vested interest in that particular person's struggles.
Right. And what I think about talking about, you know, the boots on the ground and people knowing what they need who are there. So in the most recent state budget that was just passed here in North Carolina, there is a $30,000 allocation for downtown revitalization to the Cleveland area. So I live in the Cleveland area. It's near Clayton, and it's an unincorporated area that does not have a downtown. There is no downtown in Cleveland. It is not a town, and there is $30,000 coming to Cleveland for revitalization of our non-existent downtown. Now, if someone had come to someone in the area and said, "What does this area need?" I'm sure there would be a few things they could say, but there was just this unasked for allocation that somebody in Raleigh thought would make sense. And it's, you know, talking about the boots on the ground, it does not make any sense to give us money to revitalize a non-existent part of our town. But people in the community know what we need. And that's kind of what you're saying. I mean, it's the people who are there who know.
Right. Well, and when you free up people that maybe have more of an entrepreneurial spirit anyways, and you free them up with that by removing the barriers that they have to owning a business or paying, you know, just that you reduce the taxes that they have to pay, you are creating a way for those boots on the ground to actually respond to the market and to the signals that the consumers in that area are sending to them. But when we have regulations and we have extra unnecessary tax burdens and we have money coming from elsewhere that is allocated for one particular project when that's not really the project we need, then we're not really helping. So it's great to have good intentions, but what's more important is sound judgment and making wise choices that are in the best interest of the citizens that live in our communities. And the best people to be able to advocate for those choices are the people in those communities, not the state government, not the federal government, but the living, breathing human beings that are residing and carrying the burdens of those next to them.
And it just seems like a compounding problem, though, too, because as the government steps in to do more of these things, you'll have the people who maybe would or are thinking about or would want to do these things going, well, my tax dollars are already going to this, so I can't put more to it or that much more into it because I'm already have this tax burden and is going for that purpose. So it's just like it kind of a, you know, snowball effect, downhill, you know, compounding issue.
Right. Absolutely. And that's why I believe a return to federalism, and what I mean by federalism is that what federalism brings along with it is decentralization of government. And that means that communities are better equipped and they have more freedom to have say in their communities. And so they are freed up to use the funds that they have earned to give in ways that they see as valuable and worthwhile. I think that there's this huge fear that if the government doesn't take our taxes and redistribute them, that poor people will suffer. But as we've seen over the past 40 years, the decline in the civic involvement has led to just greater government. And I mean, if we all just look around at society at large, do we really feel like we're better off? I would venture to say that if private citizens were able to retain more of their money and they simultaneously were encouraged to care for their fellow man, we would see a lot more accomplished on behalf of the poor and the hurting.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on and talking with us about your article. And if people want to read it, they can go to ncivitas.org. It is called When Government Grows, Community Dies. And thank you again, Brooke.
Thank you, Matt.
If you like this show and want to hear a segment again or want to check out one of our past shows, head over to freedomactionnetwork.com or check out some of the other shows the Freedom Action Network has to offer, like Free to Brew, where host Greg Polcher uncovers how freeing up markets, protecting property rights, and an entrepreneur spirit has rejuvenated the craft beer industry. Listen to the show for interviews and commentary from brewers, policy experts, and more. Let Greg show you there is liberty in beer. Or check out the NC Gun Dad Show, hosted by me, Matt Calder, where I talk about guns, gun rights, and Second Amendment issues of the day. Also, where we explore how being a father informs being a responsible gun owner, and more. Again, that can all be found on the Freedom Action Network website at www.freedomactionnetwork.com. So now we are going to be talking with Francis DeLuca and Susan Myrick of the Civitas Institute to have a conversation about the most recent election cycle and all of the close races and contested races. And there were questions about the elections and the voting and voter challenges. And in response to that, it seems like the State Board of Elections has decided to put some hurdles in, tighten some things up around this issue. And to kind of bring us in on that will be a conversation with Susan Myrick and Francis DeLuca right now.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you, Matt.
Hi, Francis.
Hello, Susan.
How are you?
Yeah, kind of interesting stuff going on with the, and we can't even really say the elections board.
This is
the elections board staff.
That is. And you know what, Francis, even though we're talking about not having a board right now, so we really can't talk about the board, but whenever we talk about the State Board of Elections, we're really not talking about board members. We're talking about the staff. They move the show down the road, and usually, the board members just sign off on whatever they do.
That's right. And we saw that in the months leading up to the 2016 election, just like we have seen it over time in all of our elections laws.
That's right. And what happened last week, and we saw it coming, was the State Board of Elections held a hearing on proposed rule changes. Now,
you say proposed rule changes.
Well, proposed new rules,
right,
and some changes to existing documents.
Because perhaps we should start by saying the State Board has never had rules.
That's exactly where I was going. And they've never really sat down and talked about them. That's the one, and it turned around to bite them. But that's the one good thing the Republicans thought they were going to do when they moved into power at the State Board of Elections with the governor being elected in 2012. They were going to bring the Board of Elections in line and actually make rules like the law tells them they do. Before, they never made rules. They just did what they wanted to do when they wanted to do it and wrote a memo about it.
Right. In fact, they have a term for them. They called them numbered memos.
Numbered memos. That's
and,
right.
And that was strictly the executive director of the state board would sign off on a numbered memo with no input from the appointed board of elections members.
That's right.
And they considered that to be governing language for our elections.
That's right. And when Democrats were the majority for decades, what they liked to do was create these memos, change the processes, change the procedures.
Change the law.
Change. In the end, they were changing the law, but they'd have the legislature come in behind them and really make it legit.
Right, they would ratify.
They came in session. That's exactly right.
They would administratively interpret the law to mean something different than what the law said, and then the legislature would come in behind them and change the law so that their interpretation was now the law.
That's right.
Instead of,
so the Republicans come in 4 years ago and they say they're going to do it by the book. We're going to have rules changes. Unfortunately, as they're going out, as they're leaving, they okay this list of changes and new rules that they evidently, I'm hoping they really didn't look out, because if they had, I would hope and pray they would have stopped it. But
really,
to vote for it without looking at it is just as bad. So what
and
am
for
I saying?
Really for 3+ years, they did nothing on rules or anything.
They had meetings.
They did have meetings.
Yeah, unfortunately.
But as we know from some of the emails and everything we've gotten and looked at, these rules were really written basically in the early 2017.
That's
so
right.
They weren't like being developed over the course of the past 4 years. They were developed after the last
election. After the election, especially the rule about protests. And that's what we're going to talk
about. And that kind of goes, there's two real things here. You're going to talk about the protest rule. I also have a problem with the rule that gives the executive director almost dictatorial power over our elections.
It's terrible. It's absolutely terrible. And if I was Kim Strack, I'd be embarrassed to have it as a rule. Because what she's doing is saying she, as the director of the State Board of Elections, can dismiss a election protest out of hand without a board of without the State Board looking at it. And it also gave power to all 100 elections board director to do the same thing within the county. Yeah. And that goes absolutely opposite to statute.
Right, and that's on the election protest.
That's right.
Yeah, you know, which is mostly what we're talking about today. But it also gave the executive director of the state board the ability to actually move elections.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah.
Yes, that's true.
With no oversight by anybody else.
That's right.
It gave them... basically, I think the board would have to intervene to stop it. It was, you know, in kind of unprecedented. Our state election law does not give anybody that power.
Right.
Definitely not an unelected.
Right. An employee of the state. An employee of the state. Non-elected, you know, and some people would say a political appointment, and I'm prone to agree with that assessment of the appointment of the director.
Let's get to the heart of the matter, because you know, and you're an elections expert. You've worked in elections for years. Our election system is not really the only safeguard and check in our election system. Is the average citizen who wants to get involved in monitor what's going on? Maybe, you know, file complaints, which is in the law that they can file election protest to protest procedures, counting, or individual voters that they don't feel are authorized to vote. So what are they trying to do to stop about that process?
With these new rules changes, what they're doing is intimidating citizens. It is true. Citizens, voters are the only people that can file election protests. That's it. They actually name candidates too, but candidates are voters. So voters are the only people that file protests. And what an election protest is a form that voter uses to explain what they saw went wrong with the vote, whether it's a challenge to a voter registration, which in the end becomes a protest, whether it is something like we saw in Durham, where they protested over the way they counted the 90,000 votes at the very end. We saw it in Bladen County, over 400 people had questionable mail-in ballots. The only people that could point that out to the authorities is a voter, and they had to have one voter say in that county, say, there is something wrong with those votes. If that voter hadn't said that, nobody would have ever looked at them. And so what these new form is doing is intimidating that person and make it harder for that person to present that protest. It's putting all of the responsibilities on the protester. And at the same time, the protester is being made to swear that everything they know, everything they say is true, instead of it being a protest and taking it to a hearing where we can produce evidence. So in the end, if you read these new rules, you'll see that it's going to be almost impossible for someone to protest without fear of retribution in the end, because it looks like the state board is setting them up to be sued or to be charged with a crime if, in fact, they can't prove their case without a reasonable doubt.
The charge with the crime is really that is the intention of the rule. It is to intimidate people in the people, including, as we know, Democracy North Carolina helped to write this rule.
That's right.
They want people, they want ordinary citizens who get involved in the process to actually be criminally liable for making any mistakes, more so than they want people who
commit voter fraud.
They won't, you know, they want to protect people who commit voter fraud, and they want citizens who are trying to stop voter fraud to be criminally liable if they make a mistake. They also added the hurdles of notice, you know, in terms of if you file one of these things, all the notices you have to do. We're an organization. They would be difficult for us to comply with.
Right. It's up to the voter who protests to find all the addresses for the voters that would be affected. So take Bladen County. The person that protested that would have had to send...
How many, 200?
Well, actually, it was over 400.
400.
Would have had to send letters to all 400 of the people that were affected in that race. And they had to do it within one day of the protest.
Right. They had to do it immediately almost upon protest. So think about that. We're talking an expense out of their pocket of over $200 just out of their pocket to file a protest to help keep our elections clean.
And this responsibility used to be the state boards, or is the state boards right now before these changes, if they're implemented. Also, to bring back the criminality of this, they actually have two places where you check off on the new form that you check off that you know it's a crime to do certain things. I did a little quick search of the word crime in the elections law in North Carolina. It was used three other times, and it had nothing to do with, not even fraudulent voting. It had to do with people that had committed crimes and were felons and were not eligible to vote for the most part.
This is a case where they're trying to create a rule that is not supported in the law.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that is a problem. And it's scary because they're doing it with really no supervision.
And Francis, the way we know Democracy NC, which we know quite well, was part of this and probably was the initiator of these changes, was that you actually wrote an email to the state board and just asked them point blank, was Democracy NC involved in this in these changes?
And they said yes. They said they helped to develop them. In fact, they were one of the only groups that actually got to review these rules before before the appointed members of the state board, looked at them. We at Civitas have been very active in election stuff. We have worked on it. We have talked to them. We have filed suits.
We have.
Well, when they proposed these rules, did they contact us and ask our opinion? No. They asked the lobbying group, Democracy MC, which are registered lobbyists, and they're far left, and they asked them to help them with this.
Yes, and they've known all along that they're politically active. They are activists.
They actually have sued. They're part of suing the state.
That's right. That's exactly right. Democracy NC is in the forefront of every time there's a lawsuit, Democracy NC is somewhere there. And I tend to believe that the state board likes to keep them close at hand just because they fear them, perhaps. And maybe they don't. Maybe it's a little bit of both. They love them and they fear them at the same time. But we do know that these changes or these new rules are really, really bad for North Carolina. North Carolina, right now, we vote on the honor system. Everybody says can say that they're an eligible voter, they're a citizen, and we have to take their word for it. So if we get to the point where after an election we see problems, but the citizens and the voters who are really charged with the responsibility to do something about it fear for themselves, for their livelihoods, we will have no checks and balances, absolutely none.
Yeah, I agree. And this is, you know, hopefully these rules, when the new board gets appointed, these rules will be drastically changed, and they should really go back to the drawing right. board and start over.
Speaking of the new board, and we'll close.
Full disclosure. Should I say full disclosure?
Well, let's do that in just a minute. But first, let's talk about the new board. There is no board of elections right now. When the legislature drew up new legislation calling for a bipartisan board instead of three Democrats now, because there's a Democrat in the governor's mansion, and two Republicans, there would be four Democrats and four Republicans. And it's funny to me that Rory Cooper is against that, because I thought the people on the left were all about being fair.
And about,
I thought it would be perfect.
They think we should have some
everything
kind of
bipartisan
or nonpartisan, like for redistricting. But yet when it comes to our elections, no.
Oh, absolutely not. They know how important it is to control the administration of elections. It's amazing what you can do when you're in control of the elections. Now tell us about your full disclosure.
Well, before full disclosure, I want to make one comment on what you said about control of the elections. And the fact is that even under 4 years of a Republican governor, the Republicans never had control of the elections
right.
board or staff. You know, it was still run by activists in the
That's
staff,
right.
liberal activists within the staff.
This is definitely the swamp in North Carolina. Yeah. There's no doubt about that either.
Now, my full disclosure, and we probably should have started out the show with that. I'm a registered Republican, and the Republican Party has nominated me to sit on the new Ethics and Elections Board that will also have oversight over lobbying. I previously sat for a little over a year on the Ethics Board, and that was one of the reasons my name got put into it, because I had experience and I do a lot of work in elections. So, you know, probably among Republicans, yourself excepted, there probably aren't a lot of Republicans who know more about the election structure and everything than the two of us sitting here.
I agree. I hope we get to get back together very soon and talk a little bit more in depth about the State Board of Elections and all the things that they've gone through in the last 4 years while Republicans supposedly were at the helm. And maybe we can do that.
We may need several sessions to do that.
Thank you very much, Francis.
Thank you, Susan.
Well, thank you guys for being here and talking with us about all that. And I do want to interject one little point. Susan, if I remember correctly, you're not a Republican, are you? Registered. You're unaffiliated, aren't you?
I'm a disenfranchised unaffiliated voter.
There we go. I thought you were from our last conversation.
Several years now.
All right. Well, again, thank you both, and we'll definitely have you on as more develops with this and as we figure out how things are going to go.
Thank you, Matt.
Thanks, Matt.
If you like this show and want to hear a segment again, or want to check out one of our past shows, head over to freedomactionnetwork.com or check out some of the other shows the Freedom Action Network has to offer, like Free to Brew, where host Greg Polcher uncovers how freeing up markets, protecting property rights, and an entrepreneur spirit has rejuvenated the craft beer industry. Listen to the show for interviews and commentary from brewers, policy experts, and more. Let Greg show you there is liberty in beer. Or check out the NC Gun Dad Show, hosted by me, Matt Calder, where I talk about guns, gun rights, and Second Amendment issues of the day. Also, where we explore how being a father informs being a responsible gun owner and more. Again, that can all be found on the Freedom Action Network website at www.freedomactionnetwork.com. Joining us now is Susan Myrick, Elections Policy Analyst for the Civitas Institute, and she's going to talk with us about how unaffiliated voters are swiftly becoming the second largest voting bloc in the state, overtaking Republicans imminently, right?
Imminently. In short order, I would predict less than 3 months with the way the numbers are moving now. We've been watching this trend take place ever since January 2009. I say we've been watching it. Maybe I haven't been watching it since then, but I can use the Civitas website of CarolinaTransparency.com to actually see that it has been happening since January 2009. Right now, unaffiliated voters are just a mere 13,000 voters behind the Republican Party. While that sounds ominous for the Republican Party, I think what we've seen has been much deeper and much more of importance, perhaps, to the Democratic Party. The Democrats, since January 2009, are the only segment of voting political registration that have decreased in number. They've actually decreased by 229,000 plus voters, where Republicans have increased almost 50,000. But the difference being is absolutely the unaffiliated bloc. They've ballooned more than 640,000 voters since 2009. Now, people look at me and say, why in the world would that happen? And there's probably 100 different reasons, but I think the two major reasons is they're disaffected voters. They're not moderate. They're not middle-of-the-road voters. They all have their belief system and sometimes very, very strong, but they're disaffected and disenfranchised from the two major parties.
So this is not just new voters becoming unaffiliated. This is people leaving the Democrat Party and joining right. unaffiliated, and maybe some joining Republicans,
And Republicans are leaving the Republican Party too.
But they're still growing.
They're still overall. Growing.
Okay.
But yes, absolutely, they are leaving the party. They may be new to North Carolina or new to voting and going the way of unaffiliated. They may be moving between counties, and when they register again, they go, I'm not aligning with a party. I'm going to go the unaffiliated route. Now, this is the second reason why I believe that people would register as unaffiliated voters. In North Carolina, unaffiliated voters, and they are not, it's not an independent party. We talked about this before,
right.
Matt. North Carolina doesn't have an independent party. It could have an independent party if somebody wanted to get that moving. But what unaffiliated voters are exactly what the name indicates. They're not affiliated with either or any party, including Libertarian Party. They don't have an affiliation, but they are allowed in North Carolina to vote in a primary. They just can vote in only one primary on primary election time. I can't even say election day anymore because of absentee voting. But if you're an unaffiliated voter, you pick the primary you want to vote in, and you get that ballot. So it's very people think that's a plus. And they'll move with it. And we've watched it moving since 2009. I've actually been watching it more from 2010 or 11 and seeing the changes. Now, as I said, unaffiliated voters aren't middle of the road. They aren't moderate. A lot of political consultants like to think they are. But Civitas does polls every month. Live caller polling, and in August, and just like this month, we always do an unaffiliated poll where we just target unaffiliated voters. And what we've seen in those polls ever since 2010, that the unaffiliated voters are leaning and identifying more with Republicans. That does not mean it's going to stay that way, but right now that's where we are. And we have an unaffiliated poll this month, and we'll see if that trend still holding strong.
Well, I'm an unaffiliated voter. Maybe I'll get a call.
I'm an unaffiliated voter. Maybe I'll get a call.
And I just from the first time I registered unaffiliated because, you know, I mean, I guess there's a number of reasons to do it. You get the reason to to be able to vote in either primary, the reason of you really just don't identify as either of the major parties.
Right.
I mean, there's a whole host of reasons.
Well, I'm a lot older than you are, Matt, but I remember when I registered to vote the first time in North Carolina, I was told that if I didn't register as a Democrat, I wouldn't have a chance to vote. Because back in those days, there was only one party in North Carolina, and the election really took place during the primary. So times have definitely changed in North Carolina. There's no doubt about it. But let me give you some numbers really quick before I go. As far as counties go, right now there are 9 counties that have more unaffiliated voters than they do Democrats and more unaffiliated voters than they do Republicans. There are 23 counties that have more unaffiliated voters than Democrats and 39 counties that have more unaffiliated voters than Republicans. And it's fluid. You can watch these counties move constantly in that direction.
And do you actually have those 9? I mean, we can't go through all of them.
I do.
I'm just curious, what are the 9 where they're the largest voting block?
I'm going to tell you the 2 that sat out there by themselves for the longest up until the last few months. And that would be Currituck County and Watauga County. They were the first 2 to do that. I believe Currituck was before Watauga. But since then, Camden County has joined in and they're right in there. They surround Currituck County, or they're very close. Henderson County up in the mountains, New Hanover County down on the coast, Polk County up in the mountains, Transylvania and Watauga. So it's really a opposite ends of the state phenomena right now. But like I said, we're seeing it all over the state, one way or the other.
That makes sense for me. The Watauga County, with the university being there, and Boone, and that really makes sense.
Yeah. It does. And Henderson is different than Watauga. It's different than Buncombe. It's a mountain county. It's more Republican. So it has a different, almost a libertarian feel to it.
Well, the mountain people, they just want to be left alone.
That's exactly right.
I mean,
right.
That's people on the coast and to another degree, but in the mountain, there's a really strong, you know, Raleigh's what happens down there, leave
right.
me alone.
And, you know, that's what I see out in the northeast, the Outer Banks, Camden, mm-hmm. Dare, and Currituck. They're very similar in that way to the mountains.
Definitely. I mean, that's eye-opening, but it does make a lot of sense.
It sure does. I will come back, I promise, and give you an update as this moves along. We'll see if it happens in 1 month, 2 months, or 3 months.
So is there a betting pool? Is there going to be a pool around the Civitas Institute office?
I think I'll put together the last trend for the last 3 months, and maybe we can get a pool going.
Maybe there's a line, a 3-1 odd, 2-1 odd. I don't know how exactly all that works.
That's a good idea. And maybe if anybody listening would like to get in on it. I don't know if that's legal or not. But.
Well, they just vetoed the game night for nonprofits.
May not be able to do that.
I guess y'all could have had that going, but the Governor Cooper vetoed that bill.
We'd like to hear from you, though.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us on What Matters.
Thank you.
Thank you again to Susan Meyer for taking the time to talk with us about what's going on with unaffiliated voters. And also, thank you for that conversation you had with Francis about what's going on at the State Board of Elections. You are always right there for us on any elections issue. Thank you as well to Brooke Medina for coming on for the first time on this show and talking with us about her article about what's going on in our communities. But also thank you to you, the listeners, for taking the time to sit down with us on a Sunday night and listen to this show, or on a Monday if you're listening to it then, or whenever you're hearing it throughout the week. Thank you for taking the time. And if you're not already subscribed to the podcast, make sure you're doing that by searching for What Matters in North Carolina where you're listening to podcasts. You can go to the website and listen to more episodes of this show or other shows on the Freedom Action Network by going to freedomactionnetwork.com. Also, you can follow along with us on social media on Facebook and Twitter at What Matters NC. We will catch you again later.